This podcast is sponsored by ebookit.com, self-publishing solutions for the independent author and small press. Visit us today at ebookit.com.
Welcome to the Toastmasters podcast, the official podcast of Toastmasters International. Hello, everybody. This is Greg Gazin.
And I'm Ryan Levesque.
Ryan, we have a special guest here today. Who are we speaking with?
Yes, Greg, I am fanboying out for our interview today with John Bowe. John is an award-winning author, speech and presentation consultant. He's contributed to The New Yorker, The New York Times Magazine, GQ, McSweeney's, This American Life, which is one of my favorites, and many other media outlets. He spent the last 8 years working on his brand new book entitled I Have Something to Say, Mastering the Art of Public Speaking in an Age of Disconnection, published earlier this month by Random House. John's book has also been nominated for the Fall 2020 Next Big Idea Club, which is curated by celebrity authors including Adam Grant, Susan Cain, Dan Pink, and Malcolm Gladwell. Amazing, John. Amazing. Wow. So John's provided an educational session at the 2020 Toastmasters International Convention based on the content of his book. And he also was profiled in the August 2020 edition of the Toastmaster magazine. John Bowe, welcome to the Toastmasters podcast.
Hey, guys. Thanks for having me. Glad to be on the show.
Welcome, John. So we're going to talk a little bit about you, a little bit about your book, a little bit about everything. But in your book, you talk about the origins of public speaking. And in your presentation, you stated that Aristotle was a Toastmaster. But let's face it, Aristotle lived 2,500 years ago, long before Dr. Ralph Smedley created Toastmasters. So can you explain that a little bit?
I mean, I was just being a little bit cheeky. Clearly, Aristotle lived and died a little while before 1924 when Toastmasters was invented. But I just wanted to make the connection and make it very clear that this thing we do at Toastmasters has a really, really, really long and erudite and interesting history. You know, it didn't come out of nowhere. It's not a modern thing. And plus, let's face it, Aristotle's a pretty classy name.
Absolutely. John, I'd like to take a different route to get into some of the content of your presentation and what Greg was just pointing to about Aristotle. And I'll share a brief little anecdote with you. So I've listened to your presentation a couple times. And as I was listening to it this morning and reflecting, trying to figure out what is it about this presentation that has just completely swept me away. I don't want to be too superfluous with my praise here, too effusive.
Try me.
But I really was moved by this presentation. And then I had this eureka moment, and it was like I discovered the open secret of your presentation. And that is, I found myself at once inspired, intellectually stimulated, persuaded. And I thought, my goodness, John simply practiced what he preached. And going back to Aristotle's Ars Rhetorica, he weaved the parts of rhetoric into his presentation, the ethos, the logos, and the pathos. And I know we haven't talked about what those are, but I'd like to invite you to share with our audience what those three components are. And then if you would you mind giving us a peek behind the curtain into how you wove those elements into your presentation? Because I think that's exactly what you did.
Aristotle wrote the most authoritative treatise on rhetoric ever produced. And it's still completely true 2,500 years later, even if it's kind of hard to understand. And what he said in his book was, everything we say to one another is an attempt to persuade each other of something. And as we try to persuade each other of stuff all day long, as we go throughout our day, we use three different tools. One is logic, and he called that logos, and that might be data or facts, logic. The other is pathos, and that's the emotion that we seek to create as we say something. So we can get somebody laughing or get somebody angry, and all of that is part of our attempt to get them to understand us and believe us and see things our way. But the third and the biggest tool that we use is ethos, and that is our character. And that includes who we are or who people perceive us to be, but it's also the way and the competence with which we explain our ideas. And he said, of these three things, ethos is by far the biggest. It's the controlling factor in persuasion. So it's not facts, it's not emotion, it's this kind of nebulous idea of character.
Mm. I've got a follow-up question. Is ethos something that needs to be added into the speech, or is it just generated by the context that you, for example, John Bowe, you are who you are, you have a reputation that precedes you as a journalist with a certain number of qualifications and accomplishments, and you present yourself a certain way as you're speaking that carries through that ethos. So is it like already there in the water that you're swimming in, or is it something that a speaker needs to intentionally somehow add or weave into the presentation, as I assume they would with logos and pathos?
I think this is one of those windows into the ancient way of teaching public speaking that I found so fascinating. For the ancient Greeks, they really presumed that your audience doesn't know you. You have to go to them. You have to go to them on every level of your speech. Mm. So how they perceive you, what words you choose, how you organize your speech, your tone of voice, that idea that I am who I am and I'm fine and you just need to get me and I am either going to get me or you're not going to get me, that wasn't part of their thinking. Mm. Every single part of your speech, you needed to reorient your thinking and your presentation towards your audience so that it was easier for them to get. And I think that's mind-blowing for modern people because we are also fixated on authenticity. I know that before I joined Toastmasters, before I started thinking about these things, that was my attitude. I am who I am. And even if I don't know how to talk, that's who I am. And to alter that or be self-conscious about that would be horribly inauthentic. Mm. So now my thinking is 180 degrees different. It's my job to make it easy for people to understand me. And part of that, you know, it's an act of generosity. People are so overwhelmed by information. They don't know who I am. They don't, you know, if somebody's hearing me, for example, in the Toastmasters speech, even if they maybe heard for 10 seconds or 30 seconds, some introduction, it doesn't sink in because they have 50 other things that they're thinking about. So my job is to not assume that they know anything about me. And in a way, I don't care because I want them to know the information. It's not about me. It's about them having a specific takeaway.
Yeah. Wow. Are you willing to take on the second part of my request here and pull back the curtain a little bit and just give us a little peek of how you worked these elements into your presentation?
That's a great question. I'm not sure I can rise to the occasion, but I'll try. Let's go to the logos of the speech. If there's something that I wanted Toastmasters to know from the speech, it was that there were these great old school ideas of Aristotle's, which if you have them in front of you and you have them written down, they're a really great template for speech preparation. And so if you add that to all the stuff that we learn in Toastmasters, it's really a boost. So the logic would be, the logos of the speech would be these three rules or principles that I distilled out of Aristotle. And the pathos, I didn't really consciously think about it. I'm naturally kind of a goofball. It's pretty likely that in any talk I give, there's going to be a moment where I say something stupid or funny or tell on myself or just, you know, hold up my own foibles in a way that ends up being funny. There was a moment where I was trying to express how my lifelong speech anxiety kind of robbed me of participation in life in a way that wasn't fun. And there were a couple times where I was practicing the speech where I got a little choked up about it, but I didn't really try to make that be especially sad or not sad or anything. I'm not that polished of a speaker where I could or would want to control that. But it was there, you know, it was there in the writing. I wanted to be emotionally connected to what I was talking about.
Yeah.
And then the ethos, the last part of it, you know, I worked my butt off on trying to make the speech be really organized and hold together. I didn't have as much time as I would like to practice it 500 times and get every single phrase and iteration super clear. But for the most part, the organization was competent. I had enough time. I took enough time to write it so that it was focusing on Toastmasters, focusing on the needs of Toastmasters and the kinds of things that we would all be interested in. And that it would be clear, this isn't a speech that I just gave last week for some insurance company or some group of Kiwanis. you know, or the Lions Club or whatever. It was for this particular occasion and this particular audience.
Well, I thought the presentation was quite powerful, and I'll tell you in a moment for a different reason. But I want to go back to, I can't recall if it was the presentation or maybe it was the article in the magazine where you mentioned that ancient Greeks developed public speaking as a mental tool and that sometimes something very small can make a difference. So, for example, you had mentioned that you could use the tense with respect to whether or not someone was trying to punish or escape blame.
Sure. When they started studying speech, it was almost like everybody, there was a gold rush on language theory. And all of these teachers and philosophers kind of rushed into Athens because there was a lot of money for being able to explain or teach speech in a new or better way than the last person. And so they kept discovering these different hacks with speech. So one hack, for example, would be to insult the person. You know, you're trying to beat somebody in an election and you come up with a name for them. You think about Paradise Lost. They called the devil the Archfiend. And John Milton repeats it again and again. The Archfiend said this, or the Archfiend said that. And you notice that in different public speakers. They'll come up with some dismissive put down for their opponent and repeat that and repeat that and repeat that. It's a really powerful trick. Or they come up with these logical ways of winning an argument. I'll give a bad example, but like the reductio ad absurdum. So you're arguing that we should increase insurance, you know, health insurance, and I'll take the most extreme counter to that argument and make it seem like it's the dumbest thing anybody ever heard of so that nobody can discuss your proposal in a reasonable way. Some of these things were small that they came up with, but they're huge in real life. And so one example was verb tense. And this isn't something that modern people think about a whole lot, I think. But what they realize is if you want to punish somebody or keep them on the hot seat, talk about their mistakes in the past tense and say, you know, you were in office for 25 years and you never solved the problem of poverty. You never helped minorities. You never helped this part of town. And you'll see a politician in a situation like that try to pivot to the future tense. And say, yes, and that's why my plan going forward promises to do blah, 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 blah. And you'll see the politician who's attacking them say, yeah, but in the past, you had 30 years to fix these problems, and you did this, and you did this, and you did this, and none of them fixed it. And you see this in regular life. You know, if your partner or whoever accuses you of doing something bad, you can sit there in the past tense trying to defend yourself, and you'll feel all of this tension. Or you can pivot to the future and say, you know what? You're right. Going forward, what do you think is the best way to solve this? And you'll often see it where someone will want to drag you back to the past and no, but you did this thing. And you say, I know, you're right. So going forward, what do you think we should do?
Our prime minister was on TV this morning talking about, I guess, the events of the weekend. I didn't get a chance to listen to it, but when I listened to the replay tonight on the 11 o'clock news, I am specifically going to watch for that.
A lot of these tricks, the power is consciously using them. So the next time someone's blaming you, whether you're at fault or not,
yeah,
pivot to the future and they might get enraged, but they can't do much about it. The thing about all of them is they work just as well for horrible people as for good people.
Right. They're neutral tactics.
So let's shift a little bit to you for a moment. And of course, this is why I'm a bit of a fanboy. I mentioned it on other podcasts before where my first table topic we do in Toastmasters, I didn't make it past 12 seconds, I should say. And I've walked away from lucrative business opportunities because I didn't have the confidence. You're a veteran journalist, veteran author. You come across articulate, you come across confident, yet you yourself had mentioned that you had some issues. In fact, you said in the article, you had trouble putting brain and mouth together, which then, of course, led to your 8-year immersion in the topic. How did you overcome? How long did it take?
Well, I have a lot to learn about public speaking, but the one thing that I have learned is if I prepare for a speech, I can do anything and say anything. And if I don't, it's kind of a crapshoot. So in the past, when I would have to do public speaking, I was fine at appearing on stage or appearing before my big moment, and I could present an amiable version of myself and kind of talk about what I was supposed to talk about. But I could never complete my thoughts. I could never say exactly what I wanted to say. And so if you're a writer and you spend years writing a book, obviously you care about your subject. And I would be given opportunities to talk about my subject and speak in a very mediocre way about them. And afterwards, I would feel nearly suicidal because I just felt like what I had explained was it was okay, but it was never very much better than okay. And if you spend 3, 4, 5, 6 years writing a book, it better be better than okay.
Yeah.
So it wasn't that I completely sucked and I completely had a meltdown and froze up, but I never could finish the thought. And I didn't know that there was a technique to this. So for example, Toastmasters, one of the lessons I had was to think about your purpose for a speech. And what do you want the audience to know or do as a result of your talk? It had never in a million years occurred to me that that's something I'm supposed to do or figure out.
Mm, yeah. You thought a good story was a good story.
Good story. And I thought, you know, show up, just be yourself.
Yeah.
It's a nice idea, but it's not really what you're doing when you do public speaking. You're there for a reason. And one of the reasons is to not waste people's time. So you need to be clear about what do you want them to walk away with.
Wow.
But that had never occurred to me. It never occurred to me that I needed to think it through. I mean, I write about this in my book. It's like I didn't understand the public part of public speaking. And I write about this. It's a good metaphor. I thought that public speaking meant taking a disk drive, you know, taking a bunch of data from my head and putting it into the audience members. But it didn't occur to me that it's an essentially social transaction, or that they're the most important part of the transaction, and that the data is the least important part of the transaction.
Yeah.
So to think about it, we are meeting here today for me to give something to you, for you guys to walk away with this thing, and that's what we're here for. It completes the thought. You know what I mean? Yeah, the data transfer is part of it, but you're transferring the data from who to who.
Right.
Data without context has no meaning.
Yeah. And data without sort of a meaning. What's the meaning? Why would you guys care about what I have to say? I have to think about that. I can't just babble.
I think you're pointing to a really key part of your presentation here as well, John, because not only was it your journey of discovery that now I can acquire these skills that make me more effective as a communicator, but you go so far in your presentation to say, and I think this is part of where the downright inspiration of your story comes from, is that it wasn't just that you layered some additional abilities into your talent stack, but you said it actually transformed you as a person, that you became a different person than you were before you started on that journey. Can you maybe crack into that a little bit for us and give us a peek to, I don't know, what was the before and after of John Bowe?
Well, I think the real genius of these ancient skills that I discovered is how specific they are and how kind of overlooked they are now today. They're so obvious that we don't see them. Before learning this stuff, I thought, well, I'm a nice guy and I care about humanity and I write these books that are often about social justice and I think of myself as this humanitarian. That's great. To give it meaning, you need some technique. If I approach public speaking as this big anxiety fest and I basically hate the audience I'm talking to because they make me so nervous and I hate public speaking, it's really hard to be a humanitarian in that context. So these tools, which again are so obvious and plain that they seem almost funny to state. But the idea of thinking about the audience and building your talk on every single level, from choosing a topic to framing the topic to organizing your speech and choosing the words and then practicing your delivery and thinking on all these different levels, how can I make it be about them, is a real workout. It's a physical, spiritual, intellectual, emotional workout that really does bend your thinking more towards other people. And I think without knowing it, we're all very self-centered, and so was I, even while trying to do stuff for humanity and for other people. I was terribly self-centered until I got these skills.
Wow.
John, I have to ask you this story. You wrote a book about slavery. You wrote a book about love. How does Toastmasters fit into that trio, or is it part of the triangle?
My discovery of this subject came about in the most accidental, backwards way possible. In 2010, I was doing an oral history about love. So I was interviewing people from all over the states about their experiences with love. And one of the people I interviewed was my step cousin, Bill, from rural Iowa, who was the family recluse. I had met him two or three times over the years, and he was very sweet, but he was indeed very eccentric, and he had lived in his parents' basement until the age of 59. I grew up in Minneapolis, and we would talk about the family at the dinner table, and at some point, the news came over the transom that Cousin Bill had gotten married. For years, we just wondered about the details of that. How in the world did that happen? Later, as I grew up and I became a journalist, I had license to pry into everybody's life and ask them personal questions. So I asked him, I circled back to him and I said, can I interview you for my book about love? And he said, yeah. And I said, how did you go from being the kind of guy who was completely isolated for almost all of your life to being able to talk to someone and break out of that isolation? I completely expected that his answer would include psychiatry or meds or therapy or something that involved rearranging his emotional life or his emotional behavior. That was the only way that I could understand a possible answer to that question. And instead he said, I joined the Toastmasters Club. So he explained to me, he joined the club, he hung around for a couple of years. He did about 6 speeches in that time. And even so, somehow that was enough to completely change his thinking around and his way of talking to other people, so that instead of thinking about his anxiety when he spoke to people, he started thinking more about how they listen. And I just thought that's the coolest thing I've ever heard. And so I researched the club, and then I discovered that the ancient Greeks used to teach this stuff and that people in general need help and need education in how to not think of themselves so much and think of other people. So as a guy who had written about slavery and written about love, this suddenly started to seem like it was right there in the groove of stuff that I care about.
It's just occurring to me that I think people could view public speaking as a very narcissistic pursuit. Hey, look at me on stage with something to say. And yet what you're saying actually points to the complete opposite of that, this whole notion of caring about the audience and the public being the most important part of public speaking.
This was one of the big chestnuts that I got from Aristotle, and it's only one sentence, but I swear you could take a class for a whole year studying this one sentence and how to understand it and how to implement it into your practice. But the sentence is, the audience is the beginning and the end of public speaking.
Yeah. Interesting, not to steal away any of your thunder, but our 2020 Golden Gavel recipient, Julian Treasure, I listened to his presentation, and I recall one of the big takeaways for me was that we have to be better listeners.
Yeah. Why would you say something to people if they don't care about it, or if it's the wrong time, or if it's using metaphors or language or terms or expressions that they don't understand or care about? And of course, people do it all the time, but why would you if you knew better?
Yeah.
I think a lot of people, myself included, walk around feeling like, oh, the world is so disconnected and no one really listens to me. And, you know, everybody's so self-centered, they never listen to me. And it's just really easy to get into that. But when you start realizing, well, it's up to me to connect with them. It's up to me to frame the things that I'm saying in a way that's easy for them to understand, instead of me being a baby and just expecting that everybody's going to come to me and understand my deepest, innermost thoughts automatically. It's a huge shift in perspective.
Yeah, that points to why it's a superpower in today's age, the ability to do that, because most people aren't doing it.
I wrote the book partly because people have gotten so disconnected, and it's so easy to rant online and say, you know, this writer who wrote this thing online, who I don't know, and I don't know their context, and I don't know anything about them, they didn't take one part of my reality into consideration. And so I'm furious, and I'm going to write about what a horrible person they are.
There were a couple of points in your article that I found quite fascinating and sometimes almost contrary to what people often think. So for example, one of them, you said, people take on speech training, and I guess maybe even Toastmasters, to improve their communication and build confidence. Yet you're saying that they take on the speech training to help them shed a sense of loneliness and alienation. I found that powerful. The other point I found very powerful was that you say that in society today, the rising level of social isolation and mistrust in government can typically be blamed on technology, globalization, maybe uneven distribution of wealth, etc. But you say it's really more of a basic fundamental, i.e., the inability of people to talk to one another.
I am so glad. I mean, it took me forever to write the book. And part of that was because it just took me a while to bring it down to earth and get it to simple thinking like that. And when I finally did, I thought, oh, this is so stupid. Nobody's going to go for this. It's too simple of an explanation. People are going to wave it aside as being too airy-fairy or simple. And the more that I am thinking about it and talking about it and explaining it, the more convicted I am, like, yep, that's kind of it. Mm. I felt really lonely and disconnected from people because no one understood me, and it was everybody else's fault. And now that I know how to sit down and prepare a speech and unpack my thoughts and explain them in a way that whatever audience is going to understand, I don't feel misunderstood. And if you multiply that by 7 billion, it's pretty huge. Oh, it's amazing.
Yeah.
Out of curiosity, I mean, there's a lot of messages in your book. Is there one takeaway that you'd want people to have when they read your book?
Let me try to sneak in two takeaways. One takeaway is that I think all of us approach the idea of speech anxiety like it's a matter of character and personality, right? I am terrible at public speaking because I am a this kind of person, because I'm shy, I'm anxious, I had a terrible childhood, whatever, whatever, whatever. And it's really because I wasn't taught this art form that for 2,000 years, every single person who received an education got trained to death in how to do this. So this thing that we think of as an impossibility, because it's a character problem and it's hardwired, is actually a completely learnable skill, just like cooking. The second takeaway is just, I think, how much good it would do for society if everybody in school began to learn this again. Because I do think we're all walking around more than at any other time in my lifetime, thinking, oh, the world is falling apart. There's too much division between one group and another, and it's everybody else's fault, and people are so intolerant. But like a lot of these things, it begins at home. It begins with me. It begins with you. It begins with me learning to connect better with other people. So if I'm upset because the world is disconnected, I can make it be this global universal problem. It's them. It's you. It's everyone else's fault and not mine. Or I could teach myself how to connect better.
Yeah, it's so true. I mean, not only do we want people to have a voice, not only do we want our youth to have a voice, but we want them to be able to put forward their message and make sure that it's clear and it's understood.
Yeah.
And then I think another thing too about, I mean, at least the ancient way of teaching people this stuff, it really did teach you to listen better and engage better. I think it definitely taught people that clobbering your opponent over the head in an argument as a way of winning the argument isn't a very successful strategy. And so there's a civilizing influence of this kind of education that prepares people for more civilized and productive debate.
Wow.
I'm not sure if that seems timely right now or not, but that's what I thought.
I think it does. If this interview is any indication, there is a deep well in your book, and I, for one, cannot wait to read it. John Bell, this has been such a pleasure to have you with us today. Can you let our listeners know where they can get your book and perhaps how they can keep tabs on you or keep in touch with you or find out what you're up to next?
Sure. My book is called I Have Something to Say, Mastering the Art of Public Speaking in the Age of Disconnection. And you can find it on this thing called the internet and Amazon. But they also have brick and mortar bookstores who really need your business. That's a great place to buy the book. And I have my own website too, which explains a bit about the book. And that is John F, as in Frank, johnfbowe.com.
That's B-O-W-E. And I believe you could also get it on the Toastmasters International bookstore.
And that, I'm sure, supports our organization. That's probably the best place.
John Bowe, it's been an absolute honor and a privilege and a pleasure.
Well, it's been my pleasure as well to talk to you guys.
Isn't it about time you published that book you've been thinking about? We can help with that. At ebookit.com, we've been providing authors and small presses with ebook publishing services since 2010. Visit us today at ebookit.com and let us know how we can help you.